Okay, so we're on, we're live, we're going to do lab, and we're going to talk about azeotropes this afternoon. So it is, what, April 8th, 2:30 for the afternoon lab, and azeotropes are on tap. So what we already did the other day is we already discussed an ideal solution and the way an ideal solution looks in terms of its distillation. And that ideal solution, just to remind us, we can go through and look at a solution that follows Raoult's law. And what we did there is we had a graph that we had drawn that had temperature on its y-axis, and we had percent composition on the bottom. We started with A at 100% and went down to zero, and 100% of B, and it went down to zero in this way. And what we said in an ideal solution is that when we have the two boiling points of the two different materials, that they form a vapor composition curve and a solution composition curve. And so we can look at the vapor composition or the solution composition. And this is following R-O-A-U-L-T-S, Raoult's law. Okay, I got to remember how to spell Raoult's law. Raoult's law. I think that's where we're at. And what it says is that if we start at one composition in solution, so this is our starting solution, and we vaporize this, that because of the higher vapor pressure of the lower boiling material, the vapor composition is given by the vertical. And so this is our vapor composition, which is now enriched in the lower boiling A component. And that's an ideal solution. The non-ideal solution, the azeotropes, work a little bit differently. So non-ideal, this is an azeotrope. This is non-ideal. And there's a couple of different types, two different types of azeotropes. We'll look at both. They arise from different physical properties. And what they look like generally, something like this. What we have is a solution and a vapor composition that come together at one point. So this is still vapor on the top curve and solution on the bottom. And vapor and solution. But what happens is there's a particular composition that happens where it's constant boiling, constant composition. And that constant composition occurs because of a couple of different reasons. One of the things that we can have is that there can be repulsive forces or attractive forces in the IMF. So when we look at the IMF forces, in this case, there are slight repulsive forces. That cause an increase in vapor pressure. The increase in the vapor pressure causes a lower temperature boiling fraction that is lower than both of the pure materials would be. And when that happens, you cannot resolve the two materials. The two materials will boil together at a constant fraction, giving you a constant boiling fraction. So let's look at this for a second. Let me grab what I did. I want to be kind of consistent with what I did this morning. So I want to grab this guy and just see how I went through it. It's the ethanol and water azeotrope that I wanted to do that. Okay. So, and I know where I kind of want to be. Azeotrope with low boiling point. In this case, what happens is two materials can have repulsive forces. Leading to a high vapor pressure in which case what happens is exactly what I drew before. If we have ethanol and water, and we'll actually put temperatures into this and kind of make it all work out. So the boiling point of water is at 100 degrees C. So let's put water over on this side. And this will be 100 degrees C. And ethanol over here, the boiling point of pure ethanol is 78 degrees C. So ETOH, this is 78 degrees Celsius. And the boiling point of the fraction, which boils at 95.6% ethanol, so we're going to be at it here. So this is 4.4% on the water scale, and 95.6% on the ethanol scale. And the boiling point of this is 78.17. So it's just a little bit, it's supposed to be, I think the boiling point of ethanol is just a little bit higher, but we're gonna put it right in here. And so what happens is there's the ethanol, here's the water, and this is what is called the azeotrope. And when doing the distillation, what happens is this constant boiling fraction comes out. And you cannot separate the water from the ethanol more than 4.4% water and 95.6% ethanol. That it just continues to come out at that concentration until all of the water is removed. And then when all the water is removed or all the ethanol is removed, then it will go to pure ethanol or pure water. But as long as there's a small amount of water in the solution will continue to distill out at 4.4% water and 95.6% ethanol. And you cannot separate those two by distillation. And that's what we call an azeotrope. So part of while that is happening is that if we look at the ethanol structure, ethanol here is nonpolar. Yes, it can hydrogen bond, but that nonpolar component repels water to some degree. And because of the repulsive forces there between the two, it increases the vapor pressure of both the water and the ethanol. And as you increase the vapor pressure of those two, then what happens is that the system boils because the vapor pressure is equal to the atmospheric pressure. And with the increased concentration of both of them in there, you can't separate them. You can't get rid of the water out of that boiling fraction. There's just no way. And so you get this constant sort of boiling fraction, which means that you cannot purify ethanol any more than 95.6% and get rid of the water by distillation. doesn't matter how many times you distill it. Yeah, what's the question?
So last semester, Albie did this weird thing where he put water in a tube, and then he added ethanol into it, and then he marked where it was, where the volume level was, and then he shook it, and then the volume went down.
Correct.
Does that have to do with anything of this, of why they sort of stay with each other or something?
It is not why they azeotrope, but it is a property of intermolecular attractive forces that when you took a test tube and you mix in, and this happens with a lot of different liquids. Let's say that we put in ethanol and water, and so this is our point here, and we've got water, which is up in this part, and ethanol. Let's make ethanol, because it's hydrocarbon, down here. That once we mix them together, the intermolecular attractive forces between the two, they hydrogen bond, and the hydrogen bonding nature of the solvents means that the water is going to get pretty darn close to the ethanol in its hydrogen bonding. And so the volume of that system actually decreases, such that if we take this, cut it, copy and paste it in, try to get them to line up, that what happens when we mix it, that is not what I wanted to do. What happens when we mix it is that we get a homogeneous solution. So let's do that homogeneous solution this way. And we'll mix in some blue in there to say that this is our homogeneous solution. The volume decreases. The volume is decreasing because of the hydrogen bonding, and that the molecules, when mixing, are getting a little bit closer together than they were when they were just water and just ethanol. But that little bit of closeness also comes at a price, in that the hydrocarbon here has some repulsive forces with the water molecules, and that causes an increase in the amount of the vapor pressure. So the pressure of the vapor of water and the pressure of the vapor of ethanol, both of these wound up increasing, and that you get more evaporation for the solution than you did for the two neat individual materials. So it's having to do with intermolecular attractive forces, but that's because of attractive forces between the two, where we can see slightly increased attractive forces. The repulsive forces you can't see. Those are due in measuring the vapor pressures. Okay?
Cool.
Yeah, thank you. That was good. All right, one of the other types of azeotropes that we can have is where we have attractive forces in the azeotrope. So an azeotrope can also look like this. This is an attractive force azeotrope. And here we have the same sort of graph, but what happens is the two materials have slight attractive forces that make them decrease the vapor pressure. And in this case, we have to heat the system up more than we would have in order to get it to distill. And so this one has a higher boiling point temperature than normal. So here is the azeotrope. And this is a higher boiling one. This is due from materials like acetone and chloroform. So acetone and chloroform, CH Cl3 form an azeotrope. They form in a 20% acetone to 80% chloroform, and it boils at 64.7 degrees Celsius is the azeotrope. And that one is forming because of slight attractive forces between the acetone and the chloroform. And those attractive forces mean that I actually have to heat the system up. This is higher boiling. I have to increase the temperature in order to push the two things into the vapor state. And when they do, they get locked into this azeotrope and they distill out at the 20 to 80% concentration. And so azeotropes make it difficult to separate some materials because they distill at a constant boiling fraction, but they can also be beneficial. So there are some things that we can do with azeotropes, use of azeotrope. So let's talk about how to use azeotropes. And this is distillative drying, or drying by distillation. So there's a type of apparatus that is called a Dean-Stark trap. And Dean-Stark traps are tools that we use within chemistry in order to be able to dry certain chemical reactions. So we're going to have a condenser that's on here. The Dean-Stark trap will fit onto the condenser. And the Dean-Stark trap has a side to it over here. Usually these Dean-Stark traps have a stopcock on them and a little downspout. And this side piece is calibrated like a graduated cylinder and has gradations on it. The Dean-Stark trap goes down to a round bottom. And so we fit a round bottom onto this, and I'm going to cut across two pages, and I don't really want to cut across two pages. So I'm going to take this whole thing and I'm going to move it down so that the notes will just have it into one page. And I'm also not liking where that line was going. That looks a little bit better. And then down here, we hook the round bottom down here. And the chemical reaction takes place here. And we heat this the way that we would normally heat any chemical reaction. And we have a hot plate stirring mechanism that fits on this. And we'd have a jack stand that holds this whole thing up, and the whole thing would be clamped. And water would go in and out. And that would be a double wall jacketed condenser that would be there. So we would have that double wall there. And water is circulating in through this guy. Okay, and what we do is this is used in the chemical reaction, something similar to this. If we take a ketone and react it with a primary amine, so this is an amine that's got two hydrogens on it, they react with an acid catalyst to form an imine, and a byproduct out of the chemical reaction is water. The reaction, however, is reversible. And in order to push the reaction towards the right-hand side, this is imine formation, and it is called a condensation reaction. And condensation reactions produce water as a product. And if we could find a way to sequester the water and to remove it out of the chemical reaction, then then by Le Chatelier's principle, what we do is we increase the product towards, or the reaction towards the product side. So whatever I can do to remove water out of the chemical reaction will speed this reaction up and push it equilibrium-wise towards the product side. So that's what a Dean Stark trap actually does. What we do is we leverage an azeotrope, and the azeotrope that we're going to leverage is toluene. Sometimes they use benzene, but benzene is really carcinogenic. So toluene is the preferred reagent here. And water form an azeotrope. And that azeotrope of toluene in water is a 98% toluene to 2% water. And this is a constant boiling fraction azeotrope that boils at 98 degrees Celsius, below the temperature of water and below the temperature of toluene. So toluene boils at 110 degrees. Water boils at 100 degrees C. And so this is due to slight repulsive forces between the toluene and the water that increase the vapor pressure and cause a constant boiling azeotrope. So what we do is we use toluene as our solvent. Toluene is going to be the gray solvent. So we fill this chemical reaction with toluene, and we fill this arm up in the Dean Stark trap with toluene. And it gets filled all the way up to the top when I start this chemical reaction. So this is all toluene that's in here. And then this chemical reaction is evolving water as the reaction proceeds. And so what happens with this is that the chemical reaction evolves water, and the water comes up as steam along with the toluene, and some of the water, as it condenses, rolls down and finds its way over into here. And as it does, the water separates and sinks. And so the water winds up coming down and sinking by separating by density. And the water starts to fill the bottom of this reservoir. And so up above, I'm going to get rid of that. And we'll put the toluene up a little higher. Just black. So this is all toluene. And then here, forming is water. And as the water displaces the toluene flows back down into the chemical reaction, where it picks up more water, and it keeps bringing the water up and dumping it into this sidearm. And as the water accumulates, it separates the water from the chemical reaction, and the water is actually removed from the chemical reaction. And as we remove that, we can actually read how much water is coming out. And when a stoichiometric of water is pulled out, then we know the reaction is actually done. So we can measure volume-wise how much water is being produced out of this. And we know when the reaction is done by how much water has actually been liberated or produced on it. So that's a Dean Stark trap. And that should go up here. So that's one way that azeotropes can be used, is to actually remove water and remove it from a chemical reaction. And any type of reaction that produces water, Dean Stark traps are great things to be able to use to remove water out of them like that. And that's leveraging the azeotrope and how to make an azeotrope sort of work for you rather than just be a problem. So every time you see something that Mother Nature gives you and you go, oh, well, that's crappy, I can't isolate that thing, then you can always turn that around and use it and find a way to use it within a chemical reaction where we can actually do something good with it. So that's the way to look at chemistry, is look at it from both setups. Don't get too caught into Mother Nature telling you you can't do something. Okay, from azeotropes, I want to move into looking at vacuum distillations. And so the other day we talked about distillations, and let me go grab a couple images because I had some images that I drew this morning, and I'm just going to pull from those images rather than try to redraw them all. So this morning what we did is we looked at, here we go. We looked at regular distillations. And this was sort of our setup for a regular distillation. And we're going to compare this to a vacuum distillation. So this is a fractional distillation. And just a couple of things with this fractional distillation as I've got it set up. Everything in here is as we talked about. We've got the column and the long fractional column that is here. So there's our fractional column. This is called a, it's not a Claisen, but it's like a still head. Is that part? This is the condenser. And then we've got the receiving flask on the other end, and you can see the water lines going in and out to the drain. So everything is there. And the really critical thing here is the vacuum adapter, which is open. And that's open so that we don't create a bomb. So that's one of the critical spots, is that that vacuum adapter is open to the atmosphere and allowing pressure to equilibrate within the system, so pressure never builds up and pressure can be released. So that's the fractional distillation apparatus. Let's take that and look at what a vacuum distillation looks like. So the vacuum distillation is hanging out here. So let's take this drawing. And we'll move that over into our note for today. Okay, so this is a vacuum distillation. And the vacuum distillation has much the same thing. So this one, what I did is I did it as instead of a long fractional distillation, this is a simple distillation. So simple in that it's a small column, short column. And I sort of, that word simple versus fractional, I never liked those terms, simple and fractional. I like long and short, because long and short is telling me more about the size of the column that I'm dealing with. And short goes with simple, long goes with fractional. This is anything but simple when you take a look at a vacuum distillation and how much needs to go into it and hold everything in place. And so what's happening here in the fractional distillation is that we've got, and I'm gonna use a pointer in some cases. Let's see if I can bring a pointer online. I can use a little circle as a pointer. So what we've got is we've got the simple distillation apparatus that has the water jacketed condenser, which is in here. So that water jacketed condenser has water which is coming in, and it's got water which is coming out over on this side. And then the vacuum adapter is right here, and it's hooked to a trap. So the trap, actually one way that I can do this too is I can highlight things as I want and then I can delete them. That works too. So this is the trap component that's here. And the trap is made from a Dewar. A Dewar is nothing more than a glorified thermos, and it has an in port and an out port. And they're just like the vacuum traps that we use on our bench tops when we were doing the vacuum filtrations, only this is a little bit more upgraded. It's a much bigger sort of trap, and it has a much colder reservoir that we can use on it. And the Dewar is a really, really good thermos that that we put this into, and we use a cooling solution in it. And then the line coming out of the Dewar goes through a three-way valve, and that three-way valve takes it to the vacuum pump. So the vacuum pump goes up that way, and to a manometer, which is a device that we use for measuring how strong the vacuum actually is. And we have the udder flask here. This that's this piece. That udder flask is used to be able to rotate and be able to take fractions while the distillation is ongoing. So liquid would drain out of here, collect down in the bottom reservoir, and when I wanted to, I can switch and rotate to the next flask. The ground glass joint is greased and rotates. So Colin, is the trap just to protect the pump? Not entirely, yes, sort of, mostly to protect the pump. The trap is there because when you do a vacuum distillation, it is, Matt, let me get your question in a second. When we do a vacuum distillation, yes, we really do want to protect the pump. But if something goes wrong, we want to make sure that the liquid that comes out of the distillation gets trapped someplace rather than going into the pump or hitting the manometer, or it's a control on things to have that trap there. And I'm going to talk more about the trap and how the trap works and the dangers with the trap. And Matt, does it make much difference how cold the water enters or exits the jacketed condenser? Usually cold tap water is adequate to condense things, but it depends upon how high you're heating. So let's say that we're distilling at 100 degrees. Then tap water that is like around 18 degrees Celsius is going to be plenty adequate to condense the vapors. But if you're doing your distillation and you're distilling at 30 or 40 degrees, then 18 degree water may not be cold enough, and ice water may be more appropriate. So how cold the water enters is a function of how hot the distillation is, what temperature we're actually distilling at. So let me back up for a second. And you guys the other afternoon saw me show a video of boiling water at room temperature, and the water started at 75 degrees C, and I reduced the pressure in it in a desiccator, and you saw the water boil, and the water got colder as it boiled, but it boiled at essentially room temperature because I was just pulling, it was 75 degrees Fahrenheit, and I was pulling the pressure off of that system to make it boil at room temperature. You guys remember that, right? Okay, cool. So I just want to make sure I did show that to the afternoon class. Okay, so there are tables, and the tables are in certain books, and I can't remember what they call it, but they have a name for this type of table, and they have three different lines. One of them is a curved line. One of them is a straight up and down line. This is the normal boiling point. This is the pressure on the system in atmospheres. And this is the adjusted boiling point. And so what you do is you find the boiling point of your material. Let's say the boiling point of your material is normally like around 300 degrees Celsius. And if I'm looking at atmospheric pressure where this is one atmosphere, then the corresponding line between these two lines, if I make a straight line between them, would give me a boiling point reading out at 300 degrees C. But if I come down here to where I maybe have 0.1 atmospheres, and I make a new line from that 300 degrees through my 0.1 atmosphere, it would give me a new adjusted boiling point that may be like around 60 degrees Celsius. And so I could take something that boils at 300 degrees C at one atmosphere, and at 0.1 atmospheres, it would boil at 60 degrees C. Now, that's not an actual number. I just made those up. But this is what the table does for you, is it tells you how to set your pressure such that you can distill at whatever boiling point it is you want to distill at. A lot of times when we're trying to distill an oil, and that oil has a very high vapor pressure, has a very low vapor pressure and a very high boiling point, such that it boils like around 200, 300 degrees, that's an unsafe temperature at which to conduct distillation. You start doing all kinds of damage to things. Glassware can break. Plastic clamps can get overheated and melt. If there's a rupture or something and the apparatus breaks, it's a great chance of fire. And so we do vacuum distillations in order to distill something that would have distilled at a very high temperature and bring that temperature down, much like we did with the water video where I made the water boil at room temperature. And so these vacuum distillations always include a manometer, which is a pressure gauge. So that's what this manometer is. This is a pressure gauge. And it allows me to read the pressure at which I'm distilling. And the three-way valve usually allows me to adjust the pressure such that I can open that valve or close that valve to a greater or lesser degree and increase the pressure or decrease the pressure on the system such that I can bring the pressure down exactly where I want, and then I can do my distillation at a more normal temperature. That's what happens there. The trap is critical to protect the system, but the trap is also a danger. What a lot of people do is they like these traps to be very cold. So rather than having ice water in the trap, as we might normally do within our lab, they move to something like liquid nitrogen. And they use liquid nitrogen inside that trap. Liquid nitrogen has a boiling point of almost 190, I think it's 196 or something degrees Celsius. It's really, really cold. And when they pull down the pressure on this system and they pull the gases through that trap with liquid nitrogen in it, one of the unintended consequences is that they can liquefy oxygen and they can trap liquid O2. Liquid O2 is very dangerous. Liquid O2 is a strong oxidizing agent, and any organic matter that hits that liquid O2 automatically combusts. It explodes explosively and breaks the glassware, shatters everything. I know two people in graduate school that got just nailed by this. One of them ended up in the hospital for a good time. They had taken out the trap out of the liquid nitrogen and they saw the liquid in it, and they figured that the liquid that was in it was simply just some material that had made it over from the distillation and that it was just solvent. And they tried to open the trap, and when they went to open the trap, the whole thing exploded on them, exploded in their hands. And the glassware hit them in the chest and the face, glassware embedded 20 feet behind them into the wall. And they had lots of lacerations in their neck area, their chest area, their face. They were wearing safety glasses, saved their eyesight, protected their eyesight, but they did end up in the hospital and were there for quite a while. Liquid nitrogen is a dangerous coolant to use when doing a vacuum distillation like this. So my preferred solvent is to actually use dry ice and acetone. So dry ice and acetone has its drawbacks, but it's much safer to use. So dry ice and acetone is a common cooling solvent plus CO2, and this equals minus 78 degrees Celsius. Plenty cold enough to be able to condense vapors that are coming out of the distillation, but not cold enough to condense oxygen. And so you never get liquid oxygen built up in these types of traps, and you can then work safely with it and not have to worry about the thing exploding on you. The downside is liquid nitrogen, when it evaporates, it just goes into the atmosphere. You never have to clean anything. It's very clean and easy to use. When you use dry ice and acetone, you have to wait for the dry ice to evaporate. It throws acetone all over the place while it's bubbling, kind of makes a mess. And the acetone has to be disposed of into the organic waste once the whole thing is done. So there's quite a bit more cleanup that needs to happen, but it's a way safer cooling solvent to use than just going for the liquid nitrogen. So that's the vacuum distillation. And the manometer is a cool little tool. If you've never seen one before, they're filled generally with mercury, although there are manometers that are water filled as well. They work for different pressures. So this is liquid mercury that is filling this. And at the top up here, there's a vacuum in the top of the apparatus. And you measure the difference in height between the two columns. And the difference in height here tells you the pressure. And you can read the pressure right off the manometer with the differences in the height of those two two columns. The bigger that height difference is, the higher the pressure is in the system. So as those two come down much, much closer together, the pressure is coming down within the system. And that's a mercury manometer. So those are very commonly used. They're very simple devices. They're very accurate devices. A lot of labs now will use an actual wafer pressure gauge. And so it's just got a dial on it and just reads out the pressure automatically. And you hook the vacuum system to the back and it is using two wafers. And as the pressure is pulled out of the two wafers get closer and closer together. And there's a voltage that is measured between the two in some way. And they can measure the pressure and correlate the pressure to that. Those systems work great too, but the manometer is almost foolproof. It's just a very, very accurate way of measuring pressures and a very simple device. And actually, I've got my camera on. Let me grab something and show you real quick. So if you take the screen share and you stop watching the screen share for a second and you go to speaker view and you look at my image, I'm just using my web camera right now. What I've got here that I'm holding up is a manometer, but this is a water manometer. And this water manometer, I'll zoom in on it a little bit, is just made from a couple of pieces of wood and some plastic tubing. And the plastic tubing has been embedded into the wood. And I've got a metal ruler that has gradations on both sides of the ruler that I was able to find. And you can see the level of the water right now sitting in the system is just sitting equally because the system is open to the air. And I've got a valve that is a three-way valve that I've made that allows me to be able to open up this system. And the reason that I have this at home, you're wondering why does he have a manometer at home, is because I had a gas leak in my stove. And I called a repair guy to come and fix it. And the repair guy came to fix my stove. And he said, yeah, I can smell the gas and it's leaking, but I don't know where it's leaking. And so I can't fix it for you. And I recommend that you call PG&E and have them come use a sniffer and figure out where the leak is within the gas stove. And I called PG&E and they said, they don't do that. So I got online and I had known about manometers from chemistry, but also because of the trailer that I've been building that has gas in the trailer. And I needed a manometer anyway to measure the gas flow within the trailer and check for leaks in the trailer. So I just decided to build one to check the stove as well. And so I used the same device to check the stove and I found the leak and I ordered the part and I replaced the part myself just using the manometer. And that one uses a water line. And so it's only good up to about 14 inches of water is the way that that is measuring. And 14 inches of water is adequate to be able to measure the pressure output of a gas stove, which is only about 6 inches of water that it has. And the RV runs on about 14 inches of water, which is why I need the higher amount there. So anyway, that's manometers. Let's see, what else do I need to show you guys? We've got vacuum distillations, we've got manometers, and now I lost track because I was going off on the manometer and I don't know what else I need to do. Let me check notes from this morning and see if there was anything else that I covered that I didn't cover here for you guys. We did azeotropes. We did Dean Stark apparatus. We did fractional distillation, simple distillation. Oh, I know what we didn't hit. We didn't hit the gas chromatography. Let's grab this gas chromatography and start talking about gas chromatography for a little bit. This is the last thing that we need to do. So we'll throw these into our notes. Okay. The last part of this experiment that we were going to do was gas chromatography. We were going to take the samples that we had from our distillations, and we were going to have four samples that we were going to analyze. The four samples that we were going to look at was for the fractional. We would have had two samples, one that would have been at the beginning of the fractional distillation and one that would have been at the end. And so we would have had a couple of drops of solution in each one of these samples. And this would have been at 1 milliliter and then at somewhere around 14 milliliters. I would have taken a sample as well. And on the simple, I would have had two samples on the simple. And I would have taken samples there at about 1 milliliter. And the simple uses less volume. And so the simple would have ended like around 7 milliliters. And I would have grabbed a fraction at about 7 milliliters. And then the idea is we would have wanted to put these into the GC. And the GC is a tool that tells us how many constituents are within any given sample that we inject into it. So it separates out compounds based on boiling point. And it works much like TLC or column chromatography. It has a stationary phase. The stationary phase is the packing material that is inside the column. And it has a mobile phase, which is a gas, carrier gas. And so depending upon how much time the material adheres to the column versus how much time it spends in the mobile phase and the gas phase determines how long the material stays in the instrument and when it comes out. So these are Galmax. Galmax is a brand name of GCs. They're very simple GCs. They're called prep GCs. And they're called prep GCs because of the amount of sample that you can inject into them, that generally you can inject much more sample into these than something that's called a capillary GC that has very small columns in them. And the setup of the GC is that it is basically an oven with an openable top. It has two injection ports, two different columns. So here's column A and column B. And these are the injection ports where I would inject things into. On the next picture that I'm going to bring up, you'll see sort of how those injection ports work a little bit. It has a meter in the front that has column temperature, injection port, detection port temperature, output port temperature, and something called a bridge current. And they are all relayed on the same meter. It just is whichever thing I point the needle to in the dial in the front will tell what is being read on the meter itself. And there are two or three other controls here. I've got bridge current, and I've got a zero feature, which allows me to tune the instrument to zero the instrument. And then I can control the gas flow through each of the columns. So the gas flow through A and the gas flow through B. So those are all of the tunable sort of variables on the front of the GC. And in order to put materials into the GC, we put them in using a glass syringe. The glass syringes are very tiny. They're 2 microliter syringes, and they're very fragile. 2 microliters is the standard injection size that I like to use inside these instruments. The column can handle a much larger injection. It's just the smaller injection you put into the column, the longer the column lasts. It just lengthens out the lifespan of the column, and it's plenty at 2 microliters to be able to see everything that we need to see and separate them out. So how does the GC actually work? Let's grab another picture. And that next picture that I need is with my gas tubes. So here's my GC instrument. And now what we're doing is we're sort of looking at the inside of the GC instrument. And I'm going to get rid of some of these pictures and writing so that I can rewrite these things a little bit. Some of those are going to be hard to delete, so I'm not going to try to delete some of those. What we have here to annotate is a column. This is a packed column. It is usually an eighth inch to quarter inch in diameter, depending upon the size of the column that you get. It is usually somewhere in the range of 3 feet to up to about 12 feet in length. And they wrap them around in order to be able to fit inside the oven. They're usually made out of steel, stainless steel, and there is a packing material that has been pushed into them. The packing material, there are all different types. There are non-polar packing materials and polar packing materials. And the reason that I have two columns, A and B, is that usually one of my materials is for separating polar materials, and the other column is for separating non-polar materials. So I have two different columns that I can choose to use depending upon what types of samples I'm trying to analyze. That's what's there. And so what we do is we take and we inject material into the column through the injection port. The material travels the length of that column until it gets down to the end. And at the end, it gets dumped into a detector. So this is my detector. And the detector is a metal box that has two chambers. The two chambers allow for the two different sides, A and B, to go through the two chambers. And each chamber has a what is essentially a light bulb filament. So this piece here looks like a light bulb, and it's a filament, usually made out of tungsten. And then the gases flow through that chamber, out the exit port, and then out the instrument, and are just pushed entirely out the instrument and blown out the side. So that detector, how that detector works is the heart of the entire instrument. The column causes the separation, but the detector is what tells us what is actually coming through the instrument. So let's go grab that image and look at the detector and how this works. So the detector is, like I said, a wire, basically a hot wire. And it functions a lot like a light bulb. What I do is I use that current flow, bridge current knob, that was this knob here, the bridge current, and I pass a current through this tungsten wire. So the current is traveling through the tungsten wire, and it functions like a light bulb. It doesn't quite glow. It's not the glowing function that I need there, but it heats up when I pass a current through it. And once that wire is hot, then what I do is the molecules, when a molecule hits that wire, a molecule that is moving relatively slowly can hit the wire. And when it bounces off with more energy. It has stolen energy from the wire. That cools the wire down. And as the wire cools down, the conductance of a wire is proportional to the temperature. And if the wire changes in temperature, then the wire will change in its ability to conduct. And what we do is we use two different detectors. We use the one on the left as the detector, and the one on the right serves as a reference. And we calculate or measure the change in millivolts, the change in the voltage going through the wire as molecules are hitting it. And that's where our signal comes from. So the change in temperature brings about a change in millivolt signal as compared to the reference electrode. And we are able to detect when molecules hit the wire. So that's kind of how this is working. How are you guys doing? Are you following with me so far? Cool. Okay. So there is a problem, however, and the problem is that molecules are different shapes and different sizes, and that as the molecules are different shapes, different molecular shapes steal different amounts of energy from the wire, which means that the concentration is proportional to the millivolt signal. That's what we're saying here. Concentration is proportional to the change in millivolts, but not equal. It's not equal to the millivolts. So in order to figure out how much concentration is actually there, we need to do a little bit more work. And we need to look at something called a response factor. So response factors have to do with calculating how much response you get from a individual molecule. So what we do is we say, all right, we know that there is some response factor multiplied by the concentration, which is a proportionality constant. And if we look at that, that looks like the equation of a straight line, y equals mx plus b, where what we have is the change in millivolts is the y. The RF is the slope. So the response factor is the slope in the equation. The concentration is the x. And because when there is no molecule sitting the wire, there is no change in conductance, the y-intercept is zero. And so I can do what's called a Beer's Law plot. You guys probably remember Beer's Law plot from Chem 1B. And that's just what we take and we make a straight line, millivolts versus concentration, and the slope that we get out of that is our response factor. So if we rearrange this equation up here where I say response factor times concentration equals millivolt signal, that means that if I divide both sides by the response factor, my concentration then is equal to my change in millivolts divided by my response factor. And response factors are unique for each instrument and unique for each setting, so that the first time you come up to the instrument and you change all the settings, you need to measure the response factor on that instrument and then use it throughout that experiment. And if you change anything in the experiment, if you change the flow rate of the gas, if you change the temperature that the GC is being run at, or any of those factors, you need to go through and remeasure the response factor for each of your components. But so basically what's happening here now is as the millivolts are changing, as molecules are hitting the wire, a GC trace looks like this. We have time on the x-axis and we have millivolts on the y-axis. And at zero millivolts, that's that zero function where we're able to zero out the instrument. What we get is a little baseline feed. And then as materials come out, they make peaks that that take up an area. And so the area underneath the peak is proportional. This is a millivolt dot second. That's the area integrated underneath the peak. That area is proportional to the concentration of the solution. And it is the millivolt seconds divided by the response factor for each individual compound that is equal to the concentration. So you need to measure the area underneath the curve as well as knowing what the response factor is to be able to figure out how much concentration is actually there. And what we do is we measure those in terms of percentages. So let's say that this is compound A that is coming out and compound B that is coming out. This little peak right here is an air peak that comes from a little bit of air in the syringe. And we usually use it as our start point to know where this, where the trace started at. But what we could say is that the percent of A is equal to the area of A divided by the area of A plus the area of B. And if we take that and we correct it, then our corrected percent of A is, and we could say this is now corrected for response factor, it would be the area of A divided by the response factor for A, and all of that gets divided by the area of A divided by its response factor plus the area of B divided by its response factor. And then we would multiply that by 100. And that would give us our corrected percent of A in terms of how much is actually in there. So those response factors help us to figure out what the actual concentration is or the actual percentages of a component. And B would just be the reverse. I would just put B in the numerator and still divide by the amount of A in the denominator plus the amount of B in the denominator. So that's how we go through and we measure those. And those are measured off the back of the GC. The back of the GC has a couple of little outputs back here that are electrodes, a plus electrode and a minus electrode that are giving me the millivolts. And I run those through a Logger Pro software, just using the Logger Pro data acquisition and the voltmeter that comes on that. And so what we do is we actually just use Logger Pro to be able to capture this trace and then use the tools within Logger Pro to go back in and measure the area underneath the curve and have it integrate the area underneath the curve. So that's a little bit about GC and how GC works. And like I said, these are thermal conductivity meters, and the thermal conductivity meter has to do with, that's the type of detector that this is. This is a thermal conductivity meter. There are other types of probes, of meters that you can put onto GCs. Some of them are flame ionization meters that detect the changes in the color of a flame based on the components that are coming through it. There are a number of different types of detectors that are there. Those are on much more sensitive capillary GCs than what we have. So this is just a thermal conductivity meter, but works really well for the application that we're working with here. Okay, that hits everything that I wanted to do. How about questions from you guys? I've been talking now for an hour and a half. Have I? No, we started at 2:30. So 3:30, only an hour. Like I said, I thought this was going to be a slightly shorter lecture. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to address them. But that's the content that I wanted to get through for this lab and everything that I wanted to show you guys. So do you have any questions so far? You've been kind of light on the questions for me today. Nope. All right. If that's it, I'm going to call it. And I'm going to say that's it for today. And appreciate your attention. Appreciate you hanging in there with me with all these Zoom recordings. And you guys have a good weekend. And I'll see you next week. All right? Okay, cool. You're welcome, guys. You're welcome.